All right, hello everyone. I'm here, and welcome to the Deepest Law, your oasis of calm in the middle of a sea of chaos, so to speak. Sitting here with a nice cup of coffee today, a mug. Now I've taken a brief pause on my drinking of Nescafe Gold. This is the Little's Irish coffee, or Irish cream infused coffee. Lovely. So, one of the so d in the middle of this obviously extremely political week, I wanted to get as far away from the hurdy-burly of the election as possible, and just give you a little window in which to take a break from the chaos of it all, and instead focus on some little obscure nook of culture. And I wanted to concentrate today on Enid Blyton. Now, for those of you who don't know, for you, if you're an American viewer, for example, although I believe Enid Blyton sold a lot of books in America as well, G.K. Chesterton was a fan, for example. So I think she did have quite a lot of sales in America too, but she's primarily a British author, a children's author. And I'll just read you a few of her details, and then I'll explain why it is I want to talk about her today. So, Enid Blyton, she was born in 1897. She died in 1968. She was a children's writer, and she wrote, she sold during her lifetime over 600 million copies of her books. Okay, so this is a very, very popular writer, translated into 90 languages. She is the fourth most translated author of all time. And according to Wikipedia, it says she wrote on a wide range of topics, including education, natural history, fantasy, mystery, and biblical narratives. Best remembered today for her Noddy, Famous Five, and Secret Seven series, but she did write many others as well. Blyton's work became increasingly controversial among literary critics, teachers, and parents from the 1950s onward because of the alleged unchallenging nature of her writing and the themes of her books, particularly the Noddy series. Some libraries and schools banned her works, which the BBC had refused to broadcast from the 1930s until the 1950s because they were perceived to lack literary merit. Her books have been criticized as being elitist, sexist, racist, homophobic, and at odds with the more progressive environment emerging in post-Second World War Britain, but they have continued nonetheless to be bestsellers until her death in 1968. Now, I had a look, and in fact, despite a very widespread campaign by the establishment against Enid Blyton, from what I can tell from the 1930s right up until now, Enid Blyton has continued to be an extremely well-selling, best-selling author. In the 2000s, for example, she sold millions and millions of copies of her books. They've never been out of print. They keep on getting reprints. So there's been, I mean, we talk about culture wars, and I'm interested in little things like this. Like, why is it that that Enid Blyton, hated by the establishment, hated by the literary, the kind of literati. Why is it that an author like this has been pushed out? I would just as I was having a look out a look around before I came on air, I noticed that there was talk of an Enid Blyton coin because, of course, she's a female author. She sold, fourth most translated person of all time. Why? Is Enid Blyton not more celebrated, for example, in Britain? And apparently, a year ago, the Royal Mint refused to print. They refused to make an Enid Blyton coin, and it said, should Enid Blyton be ban quote banished to the past? And this is an interesting little test case of how progressive culture works, but also how, like, the middle class, in many ways, or the chattering classes, seem to form ideas about certain people in their minds, and then do all they can to control the culture, and to, you know, choose who is in and who isn't in. You know, from a certain point of view, Ina Blyton could be extremely well remembered and celebrated and put into the canon of great British people. You know, 600 million books inspired, you know, millions of kids around the world, you know, dedicated to education, you know, forthright, made it as a woman in the 1920s and the 1930s. Like, she's got a lot of things that you could spin into a nice narrative. But no, for some reason, Enid Blyton, despised and banished. Now, one of the things that interests me about this is the extent to which this has failed. Okay, the extent to which Blyton won't go away, so to speak, despite attempts at censorship, despite being banished by the BBC, despite the Royal Mint not recognizing her. You know, these books won't go away. They're still sold. They still remain in circulation in charity shops. You know, millions of people still buy these books all the time. Now, one of the reasons I got a little bit interested in this is because when I was a kid, I had a bunch of Ina Blyton books. I had The Enchanted Wood. I had The Folk and the Faraway Tree. So I like the Faraway Tree series, which had a set of characters called Moonface and Saucepan Man and so on and so forth. And the kids were called, I'm trying to remember what the kids were called now, like Dick and Fanny or something like this. One of the reasons I got, the kids were Joe, Bessie and Fanny. And then later on, I seem to remember some like little cousin arrives to hang out with them as well in one of the later books. Forget his name now. You know, they're fun books. They go to the woods, they go up to the top of this tree, and then right at the top of the tree there are different lands, and so there's like a different adventure every week. And one of the reasons I got interested in this is because when I was when AAA came along, I wanted to obviously put together a decent library, you know, for when she's a little bit older. And, you know, set about collecting books and collecting things in order for this library to come about. And I discovered that the Faraway Tree books have been heavily edited and censored in their modern versions, to the extent where they've actually changed the names of the three main characters. So Joe, Bessie and Fanny have become Joe, Beth and Franny in the modern ones. And of course, me being me, I was like, well, I'm not having this. I don't want some sanitized modern version. I want to find an original copy of this. And I set about researching, you know, how can I find the original versions. I did manage to get a really nice copy, and I discovered that there is this website called the Enid Blyton Society, which is extremely dedicated, and which, you know, lists basically every story she ever wrote, all the books she ever did, and then they kind of lobby to get these special editions done, which are then put out, you know, non-corrupted versions, you know, original versions reprinted. I discovered this kind of odd little nook of this is the sort of culture war you don't see happening, I guess. And little things like the Enid Blyton Society, you know, keeping the flame burning. So with all of that said, what I wanted to do today, I'll tell you a little bit more about Enid Blyton. She really made her name in the 1930s. She was an incredibly hardworking writer. I mean, some people would say it veers into what you might say hackism, because she she very much, I mean, I think she was one of these writers. She started at 9 a.m. And she just like, she'd write for like 4 hours straight every single day, something like that, you know. So she churned out, I mean, a huge number of books. I'm just trying to find the total number of books that Ina Blyton wrote. She wrote, let's have a look. Just have a look at her her total bibliography in the, I mean, it's just enormous. 762 books written by Ina Blyton, which is, I mean, just a phenomenal output, I suppose. Very prolific. Now, some of these books were just these series that she had. You know, the Noddy series had a lot of books. She was also famous for, there were three of those Faraway Tree books that I mentioned, but she was famous for the Famous Five and the Secret Seven. These books had lots and lots and lots of, you know, there was lots of them in the series. But she made her start writing in these magazines that came out, which had kid, you know, children's stories in them, anthologies and compilations of and children's stories. And she wrote, you know, literally thousands of these children's stories, and then they were collected together in various different collections. And I had a number of these when I was a kid, as well as the Faraway Tree. I had things like Anytime Tales, for example. I'll just show you a picture of the one that I had when I was a kid. So this is not actually my personal copy, but this is what I can remember. So I'll just share my screen. So this was one of the books I had. I had loads of these. This is just one example. And these were basically a bunch of these stories that she had published in the 20s and the 30s, collected together to make one of these books. And so most of the 768 books are various compilations of these short stories that Blyton wrote. Now, my understanding is that the Purnell Sunshine series, as it was called then, was actually just a kind of re. So I remember there was a story that I read a lot as a kid called Polly's P's and Q's. So this was about a girl called Polly who wouldn't say please and thank you, and so every time she didn't say please or thank you, her mother would sew a Q or sew a P into her dress until at the end of the story she is covered in P's and Q's. And obviously the moral of the story is say please and thank you. Okay. Now that story was originally published in something called the Second Holiday Book. Okay. But then later on it was republished in Goodnight Stories, which is another one of these Purnell classics. And then later in the 90s, it was republished again in The Cat with the Feathery Tail. And then recently, a book came out called Stories of Rotten Rascals. So these are all just different publishers who picked up the rights. And they keep on bringing out new compilations and new kind of remixes of all of these thousands of stories. So you can see how, you know, you can get up to 768. There might be quite a bit of repeated material in all of those books. But what I thought would be interesting today would be just to have a look, just have a little read through a couple of these stories together, and have a think about why is it that the progressive establishment wants to, you know, ostensibly it's about, you know, alleged sexism and racism and so on. And I mean, there's the occasional thing that you might, you know, things that were just in the culture, like the gollywog, for example. You can see why that might be a bit insensitive these days. But I'm actually much more interested in some of the other possible reasons. Like, like if you went on Amazon and you kind of typed in the sorts of things that kids are meant to be reading now, What is it that comes up? And it's a bunch of like David Walliams books and, you know, Gruffalo and all this sort of stuff. And you think, well, why is it that they want to replace Ina Blyton with David Walliams in the culture? Like, what's going on in those books as opposed to the Blyton ones? And I would say that the chief differentiator is not actually these, you know, few passages. And you can easily, you know, you can easily amend them to take those things out, and it doesn't really change the content too much. To be honest, having compared what they've done, because I actually went through and had a look, like what exactly have they changed? It's not that, you know, not too different. What's really changed, I think, is the moral sense. And I find it interesting that the progressive establishment should be so against somebody who just stands for old-fashioned, almost Victorian values. So I want to have a look at some of those tales together. And I've actually found a copy of Anytime Tales. So I think we'll just have a look at the stories in Anytime Tales to have a look at the to have a look at them together. Now, it's not the only reason, though, that she was lambasted. She was actually criticized for her writing style, that his style was too simple, or it was too not, you know, basically not up to the standard that they wanted for kids in the 50s. This was the thing that was touted. Now, just after AAA was born, when she was very, very little, I had a little go at reading, just reading some of the Faraway Tree that I bought, just to try to help her sleep and so on. Not that she would have understood anything at like 1 month old. And the thing that struck me about the writing is that it is kind of quite repetitive, and it's quite action driven. There's always like something happening, and it's a little bit frenetic in that way. But then I was thinking, well, if you're a child, if you're like, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, that is kind of what children are like when they write. So I actually think that there's something that something childlike that Blyton's writing taps into, and it's probably the reason why, despite the establishment being against her for as long as it was, that she continued to sell, you know, 600 million books. That's not a figure to be sniffed at. It's probably the reason why they've endured, because something about these stories are written in a way that connects with children's imagination. I'll just put it that way. Incidentally, if you wanted to know who the other three who were the more translated authors, only three in the world. William Shakespeare is one, of course. Jules Verne is the second one, and Agatha Christie is the third one. So those are the only three writers who are more translated than Blyton, believe it or not. So there we go. And just to give you an idea, in the UK, between 2000 and 2010, she was still on the top 10 best-selling author list for the decade, selling 30 million pounds worth of books, over 8 million copies, which put her in the top 10 list for the decade. So that kind of gives you an idea that people are still people were still buying those books last decade. I haven't seen the 2000 to 2020 list, but I just find that interesting that where there's considerable pushback against these, it's like people in their reveal preferences just don't care. They continue to buy these books. Just before I start reading these stories, I wanted to have a little look at Blyton to give you an idea of what the woman was like. I'm interested by these, I guess, low-key reactionary figures. I mean, I don't think she was like an active reactionary or anything, but she is definitely, I think, perceived as a quote unquote regressive force in the culture, that you know, that the establishment always got their sniffers out for kind of things like this, and they feel like they want to stamp it out, and I want to do the opposite. And kind of, I'm interested to know why. I'm interested to know what is it about these stories that does this. But let's take a look at the woman herself. There's a bit of a interview here. I'm gonna have to be careful because Parthe are pretty hot on the old copyright, but let's just play a little bit of it.
Down at Beaconsfield live two small girls that other children may well envy. Gillian and Imogen don't have to wait for the next Enid Blyton book to appear in the shops. They can read it as it comes off the typewriter.
So there she is, look.
For their mother, Mrs. Daryl Waters, is Enid Blyton. Every day when she's working on a book, she rattles out about 6,000 words.
So, see, 6,000 words a day is pretty, I mean, you know, that's prolific. You know, I thought, I mean, I can write quite a bit, but 6,000 words a day, that's some pretty phenomenal output on a typewriter.
In addition, there are always proofs to be read and letters from young fans to be attended to. It's a full-time job being as successful as she is, what with stories, articles, and books. Sometimes Gillian and Imogen have to insist that she must relax and play a game with them so that she doesn't overwork.
Yeah, I was interested, like, reading about some of the other bits of her life. Apparently, her daughters complained that she didn't spend enough time with them and stuff like that, that she was actually a bit of a cold mother, but yes, that's by the by.
Father, a distinguished surgeon at one of London's big hospitals, joins in too, but they have to be quick to say snap before mother.
So there we go. They had a game of snap together. Okay. So let's have a little look then at the stories. Then I'm going to have a look at if anybody's interested. I won't share my screen actually. It's the Anytime Tales. This is what I'm reading from, and I could share my screen. We could have a little look at some of these stories together. So let's have a look. I won't read it word for word, but let's gonna share my screen, get it up. Is that gonna work? Can you guys see that? Hopefully you can see this. Yep. Okay. So this is Jigsaw Joan. "You ought to be called Jigsaw Joan," said George scornfully when Joan began to do yet another jigsaw. "Well, if I like doing jigsaws, why shouldn't I do them?" said Joan. "You like collecting stamps, and Ronnie likes making things with his Meccano. I don't laugh at you for doing those things whenever you can." "But you always take up all the table with your silly jigsaws," said Ronnie. "You go on and on. I can't think what you can see in them. And I can't see what George sees in his silly stamps or you see in your endless Meccano," said Joan, beginning to be cross. "Can't you see that some people like doing one thing and some another? I'm good at doing jigsaws. You're good at doing something else. I don't see why we can't all be happy doing it, why we all can't be happy in our own way. Well, collecting stamps teaches you geography, so it's of some use. And making things with Meccano teaches you to be clever with your hands," said Ronnie. "Doing jigsaws simply doesn't teach you anything." "I'll do them just for pleasure then," said Joan, emptying out a box of coloured jigsaw pieces. "And you never know, you might be glad someday that I'm so clever at fitting jigsaw pieces together." Now notice here that it's interesting, thinking of the morality of the thing. Joan just wants to do the jigsaw for her own fun, whereas Ronnie is putting a utilitarian argument forward here for his stamp collecting and for the Meccano. He's trying to claim that there's a use to these things, whereas Joan is like, you know, well, so what? I like doing jigsaws. "We shan't, Jigsaw Joan," said George. "And remember this, when our birthday comes next week, don't give us jigsaws. We don't like them." "I'm not going to," said Joan. I've got your presents already. George's birthday and Ronnie's came very near together, only 2 days between them. So they always shared it and made one big day of it between them. Joan didn't give them jigsaws, of course. She gave George a new stamp album and Ronnie a book showing him all the kinds of different things he could build. So that's very thoughtful of Joan. You know, if Joan was a bit selfish, she'd have just bought them jigsaws, but she didn't. She thought it was like, well, George likes stamps, I'll get him a stamp album. Ronnie likes Meccano, so I'll get him a book. They were both very pleased. We've been lucky, they said. We've had ships, trains, books, and a 10-shilling note between us. 5 shillings each, said George. Lovely, we're rich. Put the note in your money box, said their mother. But they forgot and left it on the windowsill. And the wind came and blew it away. It blew it inside the room and over to the toy cupboard. It blew right inside at the very, very back. So, of course, when the two boys looked for it, it was gone. They couldn't find it anywhere. They didn't think of looking at the back of the toy cupboard. They were very sad, but it could not be helped. The 10-shilling note was gone. Now, the... Now, a little mouse ran in and out of the toy cupboard each night. It came the night the paper money had blown to the back of the toy cupboard. It was very pleased to find it there because it meant to make a paper nest. This paper would do nicely. It could bite it up into little pieces and make a cozy little nest in the little toy motor car. So it chewed up the note into about 70 pieces and made a nest of it. Before any babies came into the nest, the children's mother turned out the toy cupboard and found the mouse's nest in the toy motor car. She called the children, Joan, George, Ronnie, do come and see. A little mouse has made a nest in your toy motor car. They came to look. George gave a cry. Mother, look what the nest is made of. Our 10-shilling note all bitten into tiny pieces. It's wasted, said Ronnie. We can't spend it now. Oh, what a pity. Joan emptied the tiny little bits carefully into a little tray. She looked at them. I can see what's coming here. I'm telling you, I can see what's coming. It's rather like a little paper jigsaw, she said. If only I could fit together all the little bits properly and put some sticky paper behind, the 10-shilling note would be the whole again, and you might be allowed to spend it. Oh, Joan, could you do it? Said George and Ronnie. Begin now quickly. So Joan's deft fingers sorted out the tiny paper bits. She borrowed a new 10-shilling note from her mother to see how it looked, and then she began to do a peculiar jigsaw. Bits here, a bit there. That fits there surely, and one should go there. Straight bits, and there's another. It's coming, cried George, and so it was. It took Joan nearly the whole day to fit the many little pieces together and to stick them carefully at the back so that the note showed up whole. You're very patient and deft, and very clever, Jigsaw Joan, said Mother admiringly. But I don't think anyone would take the note. We'd better go and ask the man at the bank what he thinks. Well, the man at the bank was very surprised to see such a peculiar note, but he said, yes, it's quite all right. He would give each of the boys 5 shillings for it. What do you think of that? Well, we'll never tease you, Joan, never, said George. You're the cleverest sister in the whole world. Come and spend our money with us. They spent it, and the 2 shillings and the 6 pence were spent on, well, I'll give you a guess. You're right. A new jigsaw for Joan. She's going to do it tonight. Clever Jigsaw Joan, blah, blah, blah. So you can see here that Jigsaw Joan was being picked on by her two brothers. And the moral of the story is, don't count out. You never know when things will come in handy. So let people get on with their jigsaws. Pretty nice little tale. Nothing too bad about this. Now, there's a couple of there's a few other stories in here I remember reading when I was a kid. Let me see. Oh, it carries on. Hold on a minute. They're both pleased. Oh, it carries on. What happens? They were both very pleased. We've been lucky, they said. Oh, no. It's the same. Sorry. Yeah, it's the same story. So there's a couple of other ones here that I remember. There was Michael's new belt. I won't linger on that one. Little Queenie. The house in the fog. You can see. Interesting looking story. But I won't linger on this one. Yeah, this is one I remember in particular. Interfering Ina. This is one that has stuck with me because whenever people interfere in my affairs, I call them interfering Ina. So clearly this has stuck with me, this one. So maybe I'll read this one and see what you make of it. I wonder if you ever knew interfering Ina. She was a little girl about 8 years old, quite pretty, quite clever. But oh dear, how did she interfere with all the other children? If she saw two or three of them playing a game together, she would go and poke her nose into the game and say, "Oh, you're not playing that quite right. Look, you should play it this way." And then she would make the children play quite a different way, a way they didn't want to play at all. "Don't interfere," they would say at last. "Go away, Ina." Well, I wanted to put you right, Ina would say, and then off she would go in a huff. If she saw a little girl sewing, she would go at once to see what she was doing. Then she would say, "Oh, you are making an overall for your doll. I see. Well, you're doing it wrong. You should sew it like this." And then she would take the sewing from the little girl's hand and make her sew it quite differently. It was so tiresome of Ina. The other children got very tired of her. "Here comes interfering Ina," they would say as soon as they saw her coming. "Hello, Ina. Are you going to poke your nose into our games again? Well, go away." But do you suppose that cured Ina of her tiresome ways? Note that the subject of the bullying never actually learns from their mistakes. Not a bit. She simply loved to interfere with everything, and she was so curious about everybody and what they were doing that she was forever poking her nose here, there, and everywhere. Now, one day she was walking home alone from school. The other children wouldn't walk with her because she had interfered in a fine new game they had made up that morning and had spoilt it for them. So there was Ina walking home by herself, feeling very cross indeed. She came to a field and she heard somebody laughing. It was a funny, high little laugh, and Ina stopped to see who it could be. She climbed up on the gate and peered into the field, and there she saw a most surprising sight. She saw four little brownie men playing leapfrog. They were having a fine game and were shouting and laughing in little bird-like voices. Ina watched them for a while, and then she called them. "You know, that's not the right way to play leapfrog. You want to bend down with your back to the others, not with the front. Look, I'll show you. You know, she reminds me a little bit of the Harry Enfield character, Only Me. You know, Only Me. Don't want to do it like that." Ina is very much an Only Me character. Maybe Harry Enfield got the inspiration from this story. Who knows? She said she climbed over the gate and jumped down into the field. She ran to the surprised brownies. She took hold of one of them and bent him down. He stood up angrily. "How dare you push me about," he cried, a voice like a thrush's, clear and high. "Go away. You're interfering, little girl." "But I'm only trying to show you how to play leapfrog properly," said Ina crossly. "Bend down." She tried to bend the brownie over again, but he pushed her away and then slapped her fingers. "We play leapfrog the brownie way, not your way," he said. "Brothers, who is this bad-mannered child?" One of the brownies looked closely at Ina. Then he laughed. "I've heard of her," he said. "It's interfering Ina. She pokes her silly little nose into everything and makes herself such a nuisance." "Oh, she does she?" said the first brownie, glaring at Ina. "Well, every time she interferes in future and pokes her nose into other people's business, her nose will get longer." "Ha ha, that will be funny." He jumped high into the air, turned head over heels, and sprang right over the hedge. The other followed, and Ina was left alone in the field, a little frightened and very cross. She went home. "Silly little fellow," she said, feeling her pretty little nose, as if anything would come true. She had her dinner and then went out to play in the garden. She heard the little boy next door talking to his rabbit as he cleaned out his hutch. Ina stood on a box and looked over the wall. "Jimmy," she said, "you shouldn't clean out the hutch in that way. You should have the clean hay ready before you take out the old hay. You should Jimmy stared up at her, and he stared again. Something funny had happened to Ina's nice little nose. It had grown quite an inch longer. "What have you done to your nose, Ina?" asked Jimmy in surprise. "It does look funny." Ina felt her nose in alarm. Gracious, it did feel long. She rushed indoors and looked at herself in the glass. Yes, it had grown an inch longer, and her face looked queer with such a long nose. And Ina was ashamed and frightened. "I shall have to say I bumped it and it swelled." And the little girl, said the little girl to herself, she did not usually tell stories. She felt too ashamed to say that it had grown long because she had interfered. So note here that she's coming to learn the error of her ways, and she's feeling shame, and the story is happy with this. According to Ina Blyton, Ina should feel ashamed of her behavior because it's bad manners to stick your nose into other people's business. So, I mean, the morals are coming through pretty bluntly. So when she went to school that afternoon and the other children asked her what had happened to her nose, she told them a story. "I bumped it and it swelled," she said. "Funny sort of swelling," said Joan. "It isn't really big, it's just long." Ina forgot about her nose after a little bit and came in for a handwork lesson, which she loved. The children were making toys. Ina looked at the little boy next to her. "What are you making?" she said. "I'm making an engine." "That's not the way to make an engine," said Ina scornfully. "Give it to me. Look, you should put the funnel here." She pressed so hard on the funnel that it broke. "Oh, you interfered," said the little boy, almost in tears, for he had been very proud of his engine. "Ooh, what's happened to your nose, Ina?" What indeed, it had grown quite 2 inches longer in that moment. Now it looked horrid. Ina was quite ugly. The children shouted with laughter. "Ina's nose is getting longer and longer so that she can poke it into other people's business very easily," said Joan. "Wonder if that's Jigsaw, Joan." Well, before the day was ended, Ina's nose was 6 inches long. Imagine it. It stuck out from her face and made her look very strange indeed. Her mother was simply horrified when she saw it. "Ina, what have you done with your nose?" "Nothing," said Ina sulkily. It was no use saying that she had bumped it because Mummy was simply wouldn't believe her. "But something happened to it, something horrid," said her mother. "I must take you to the doctor." So Ina went to the doctor, and first he laughed when he saw her nose, and then he looked grave. Last of all, he looked puzzled. "I've never seen such a nose," he said. "How did she get it?" "She won't tell me," said Ina's mother. Then Ina began to cry, and she told all that had happened and how she'd interfered with the brownies, and they said her nose would grow bigger every time she stuck it into somebody else's business. "Dear me," said the doctor in surprise. "So that's what's happened. Well, I'm afraid you can't do anything about it. But can't you tell us how to cure her nose?" asked Ina's mother, beginning to cry too. She was such a pretty girl, and now she is so ugly. "Well, I can only say that perhaps if she stops interfering with other people, her nose may go back to its right size," said the doctor. "And that rests with Ina herself, poor child." Well, they went home with the mother, very sad and upset. So was poor Ina. "Now listen, Ina," said her mother, "we can't have your nose growing any longer, can we?" "Well, you must stop poking it into things that don't concern you. You mustn't interfere anymore. You had better ask the children to help you." "All right, Mummy, I will," said Ina. And she went out to find her friends. She told them what the doctor had said. "So please, will you help me?" she begged. "If I come and interfere, stop me at once. Because if you don't, my nose will grow down to my toes. And maybe I'll have to tie a knot in it to stop myself tripping over it." "We'll help you, Ina," said the children kindly. Children are always kind when they see someone in trouble, and these children couldn't bear to see Ina crying, tears all down her long nose. They had often been cross with her, but now they only wanted to help her. So the next few days, you should have seen what happened. Every time Ina came to interfere or poke her nose into something that was nothing to do with her, they spoke at once. "Ina, remember, don't interfere." Then Ina would go and read and say, "Sorry, I forgot." In a week's time, her nose was almost at the right size again, and soon it would be the same pretty little nose that it had been before. But goodness knows how long the magic will last. She will have to be careful all her life not to interfere, just in case her nose shoots out again. Poor Ina. She still looks a bit queer, but I hope the next time I see her, she will not. She will look her pretty old little self. So one of the things that interests me here is that if the the social justice crowd were taught this story, don't stick your nose into other people's affairs. You know, if every time some little busybody comes along and tries to don't. And I think this story encapsulates why people don't like SJWs. You know, just stay out of my business, stay out of other people's affairs. So next time some little busybody comes along like that, maybe you could just say, well, stop interfering. Don't be an interfering Ina. So that's one nice little story. But it's the example of the sort of thing that maybe, I mean, I can't imagine the David Wellingham stories are teaching. I mean, this is a very specific thing, interfering. But, you know, it's bad manners to stick your nose into other people's affairs. Simply not taught anymore. I think I'll just look at one more story. Cross Aunt Abatha. What about this one? A spell for a lazy boy. I think this looks like one I'll have a look at. Okay. Last one, and then we'll get out of here. A spell for a lazy boy. Leslie was one of those boys who was always late for breakfast, late for school, late out at playtime, and behind in all their work. He was lazy and slow, and he just wouldn't be quick. Now, one day, his father called him to him and spoke kindly but sternly to him. This is an example, I would say, of Ina Blyton's writing not being, if I was to, like, there's three hymns in that sentence. So, she might have taken a bit more care with that sentence there. When I do my new writing course, I will tell you all about, avoiding bits of sloppy writing like that. But anyway, Leslie, I'm going to give you a reward if you try to alter yourself. You will be one of the useless people in the world when you grow up if you don't stir yourself up a bit and really try not to be late or slow in everything. If for a whole week you are in time for everything and even first at some things and make a few runs at cricket, then I will give you a new bicycle. So let's just look at the advice this father is giving to the lazy boy here. If you don't try to alter yourself, you will be one of the useless people in the world when you grow up. If you don't stir yourself up a bit, really try not to be late and slow and everything. So what is interesting about this is the recognition that this is not just a behavioral trait when you're young. If you don't form a good habit, this is a bit of Aristotelian ethics here. This father's like, if you don't form a good habit now, you're going to grow up to be a bit useless. Now, again, I can imagine in the modern sensibility that sort of sentiment not being the sort of thing that you're encouraged to tell children. But is the father right? Is the father not correct that if this kid doesn't stop being such a layabout, he's going to grow up to be useless? I think it probably is. I think there's probably some truth to it. So why would you try to cushion young Leslie from such a truth? Question to be asked. Oh, said Leslie, his eyes opening wide. All his friends had bicycles, but his father had never given him one because Leslie never seemed to try hard at anything and didn't really deserve one. So there's the question of, does Leslie deserve a bicycle? Now, again, in the modern sensibility, I think people would think, well, come on, he's just a kid, give him a bicycle. But the father's like, does he deserve, what's he done to deserve a bicycle when he's such a badly behaved kid? So now you're going to try hard. Are you going to try hard? Said his father. Leslie nodded and his eyes shone. A new bicycle, one with a loud bell and a pump. My word, how fast he would go and what fun he would have with all the other boys. But although he had such a lovely reward offered to him, Leslie didn't feel at all sure that he would be able to be first in anything or even quick. He sat and thought about it. If I could get a spell to help me, it would make things much easier, he said to himself. I'll go to the old woman who lives in the heart of the wood. People say that her grandmother was a witch, so maybe she knows a few spells. Well, the old woman did. She gave Leslie a queer little yellow pill in a box. "That's the finest spell I know of for laziness," she said. "It gets you into your arms and legs almost at once and makes them quick and strong and active. You'll be all right if you take that. But mind, if you get that bicycle because of my spell, I shall expect you to ride my errands on it twice a week." Little sting in the tail from the old woman there. "Oh, I will," promised Leslie, and ran off with a little yellow pill. He took it before he went to bed that night. He fell asleep at once. The spell worked away inside him all the night. It got into his arms and legs and into his fingers and toes. It awoke him in the morning. Leslie began to yawn and stretch himself as he always did, but his legs gave him no time to do that. They leapt out of the bed at once. Leslie got a great surprise, but he soon had an even greater one. His arms began to work at top speed, and he found himself putting on pants and shirt and jersey and shorts faster than he'd ever done before. "Goodness," said Leslie, trying to stop his hands from putting on two shoes at once. But the spell was too strong. He couldn't stop himself at all. On went his shoes, and the laces were tied up in a twinkling. Then his legs took charge of him again and raced down the stairs at top speed. He fell over the cat and bumped his head. He made such a noise that his father was cross. "Leslie, is there any need to upset the whole household like this? What are you doing?" Leslie's legs had rushed him to the breakfast table. You see, in the modern sensibility, in the kind of milk sop 2020 lens, they think, well, what's the real cause of Leslie's bad behavior? Maybe because it's his father's too strict. Maybe because his father's, you know, doesn't give positive reinforcement. That would be the kind of psychologizing, you know, the modern therapy way of looking at things. Whereas I would just put it down to the fact that Leslie's lazy. Basically, it's not his father's fault. He needs to get a grip. Come on, Leslie. Anyway, Leslie's legs had rushed him to the breakfast table, and now his hands were helping him to his breakfast, shaking cereal out of a packet, emptying milk and sugar onto his plate, and then making him eat so quickly that he almost choked. Up and down to his mouth went the spoon, and poor Leslie had no time to swallow one mouthful before the next was at his lips. "Leslie, don't gobble like that," said his mother. "Why are you in such a hurry? Yesterday you were so lazy and it took you hours over your meal, and today you gobble so fast that you choke. Behave yourself." So it was the same with his boiled egg. His hand hacked off the table, and then the spoon dived in and out, and his other hand took bread and butter to his mouth at top speed, so that the egg and the bread were finished in about half a minute. "Leslie," said his father, laying down the paper, "Leslie, if you think this strange behavior will make me give you a bicycle, you're quite mistaken. You're being very silly. Sit back and be quiet whilst we finish our meal. I am ashamed of you." But Leslie could not sit back and be quiet whilst his spell was in him. His legs jumped up and ran him to the school satchel. His hands piled all his books in. They snapped his cap and coat and put on. Then his legs rushed him to his father and mother to say goodbye. And then he tore out of the house down the road. He felt rather sick. It wasn't all good for him to gobble his breakfast like that. "What's come over Leslie?" said mother in alarm. "You shouldn't have promised him a bicycle, Daddy, if it makes him behave like this." School was dreadful for bored Leslie that morning. He was the first there, of course. The others didn't come for half an hour. But Leslie's legs would not be going to be lazy. And neither were his hands. They were soon hard at work, pulling up weeds in the school garden, piling them into the barrow, and running the barrow at top speed into the rubbish heap. The headmaster was most amazed when he arrived at the school to see what was happening. Could this be lazy Leslie? Could this be the slowest boy in the school, weeding at top speed and wheeling the heavy barrow to the rubbish heap? Look at the headmaster here. Have a look at the headmaster with his glass, you know, wearing the mortarboard. It was too good to be true. Leslie felt very tired when the school began. He wasn't used to such hurrying and such hard work. He sank down into his seat thankfully. At any rate, he would get a rest now. But no, No, he didn't. His hands set to work at his sums, and he copied them down at such speed that Leslie could hardly see the figures. And then the spell began to work inside his head and made his his brain made him do his sums. He couldn't think of anything else but sums. Usually he looked out the window or round at the other boys, lazing away his time. He couldn't do that this morning. "You've done enough sums now, Leslie," said the master in surprise. "You've done very well. I'm pleased with you." That made Leslie glad. He was feeling very alarmed now. The spell was much too powerful for him. He didn't like doing everything at such a pace, but it was just the same in writing lessons. The boys were told to copy out a page in the history book in their best writing. At once, Leslie's fingers got to work and they wrote page after page. The master stared in astonishment. Leslie usually wrote down half a page, but here he was turning over page after page, filling it in with writing. Whatever could have happened? When playtime came, Leslie's legs shot him off to the cloakroom to get his lunch and then shot him out to the playground, almost knocking over one of the two boys. "What's the hurry now? What's the hurry?" they shouted and gave him a push. "Stop rushing like this, Leslie. It's not funny." The boys played games in the playground and Leslie ran about fast and dodged here and there, caught all the others easily and knocked quite a lot over. The other boys didn't understand what was happening and they were cross. Peter gave Leslie a slap and at once Leslie's fists doubled themselves up and began to hit Peter. "A fight, a fight," cried the boys and came round. Leslie didn't want to fight. He liked Peter, but his fists wouldn't stop lashing out at him. Then the master came up and spoke sternly and sent Leslie indoors. Leslie sat down breathless. He was tired and frightened. He wished he had never asked the old woman for a spell. School went on for the rest of the morning, and in geography, Leslie drew 6 different maps, much to the astonishment of the teacher. He also learnt 3 pages of poetry, 3 times as many as the other boy. He simply couldn't stop himself from working at top speed. His legs raced home for dinner, and his hands made him gobble up again, and his mother was alarmed. "Leslie," she said, "what happened to you? Tell me, dear. It's almost as if you're under a spell." "Oh, mother, I am," said poor Leslie. "I asked the old woman in the wood for a spell to make me quick instead of lazy and slow, and she gave me one. Because I did so badly, I wanted to earn that bicycle. But the spell's too strong. Whatever am I to do?" "I'll take you to the old woman at once," said his mother. "If she doesn't take away the spell, you'll be tired out. Come along." So they went to the wood. His mother, who had run all the way because Leslie's legs didn't seem to work, the old woman laughed when she saw what the spell had been doing to Leslie. "Okay. I'm sorry," she said. It only worked like that on a really lazy boy, one who had never in his life tried to be quick or punctual or hardworking. I didn't think Leslie was as bad as that. "Please take the spell away," begged poor Leslie. But the old woman couldn't try. "You'll have to put up with it for a day or two," she said. "But if after that, you yourself try to be quick and early and work hard, the spell will gradually die away. But if you get lazy again, I'm afraid it will come back and you'll do everything at top speed and annoy everyone and get very tired." So Leslie put up with it for 2 more days and the spell seemed to die away. Leslie tried to be hard and early for everything and work hard after that, and he found it wasn't so difficult as it seemed. But dear me, he had only to get lazy for a few minutes to start up at top speed once more. You'll be glad to know that he got his bicycle. Are you a lazy child? Tell your mother to let me know, and I'll see if I can get a top speed spell for you and cure you too. So there we go. That's a spell for a lazy boy. So you can see, I mean, it's a very similar idea to the interfering Ina, where there's this corrective that comes along, which is a kind of a punishment. And it's like, well, you know, if you slack off a bit, the spell's going to come back. And this is very much part of the kind of the morality of Blighton. So I'll just come out of here and we will come back, see what people have been saying in chat, and then we'll get out of here, I think. There we go. Somebody's saying this is basically Clockwork Orange. Yes, is saying, "What's the moral of the story? Crack is good." No, the moral of the story is you need to be you basically need to kick up the backside, and this spell is the kick up the backside, basically. There's that. Shall I do one more? If you want one more story, I will press one in the chat, see what people say. One more story, see what people say in the chat. Press one or press two if you just want me to bugger off. Somebody's saying, my God, this is setting up the kid for perpetual anxiety. I don't know. I mean, he doesn't stop being lazy, for God's sake. All right, they do want one more story. Okay, so let's have a look. Okay, we'll do one more. So just have a look through. I'm just having a look through to see what looks interesting. But anyway, I mean, people are debating the moral of the story, and people say, well, Edith Blyton was quite unpleasant in real life. You see, the thing is, all these stories about Edith Blyton being unpleasant and so on, how much of that is the establishment propaganda ensuring that you know bad things about her? People were, I think, you see, look at the state of this though. Okay, this is all of the people in the chat are presumably, you know, on the quote unquote right, and yet a story like the spell for a lazy boy seems to have triggered even you. And this is an example of how I think quote unquote Cthulhu swims left, right? It's like, well, all of you are coming up with these kind of basically progressive, modern, namby-pamby objections to what is, in effect, a very simple morality tale. Don't be lazy, or you'll get a kick up the arse, and, you know, we'll send you to the old witch, and she'll give you the spell so that you're basically on tender hooks for the rest of your life. Or, and just like Ina, you know, don't interfere, otherwise your nose will grow forever, you know. So, let's have a look at one more. And then I have noticed, and there are some super chats too. I'll do those after I finish the next story. So, we'll do it by vote, shall we? Okay, I'll share my screen again, and then I'll give options, and people can vote, and I'll go with the majority. Okay, so there's the surprising broom. That's option number one. Okay. Surprising broom. There's the old red cushion. That's option number two. Peep into the magic mirror is option number three. And she stamped her foot is option number four. So if you want she stamped her foot four, if you want peep in the magic mirror three, if you want the old red cushion, that's two. And if you want the surprising broom, that's one. So cast your votes now, and I'll just kind of see what the majority is, and I'll go with that. Let's have a look. Seems like people want number four. Quite a few twos. I think four has it, to be honest. I think it's four. So let's go for number four. So number four was she stamped her foot. Matilda had a dreadful temper. When she was in a rage, she went red in the face, shouted, and then she stamped her foot. Matilda, please don't stamp your foot at me, said her mother crossly. No matter what you want, I shan't give it to you if you stamp like that. It's rude. Again, I think the modern sensibility would say, well, probably the problem here is her mother's getting cross and Matilda's been taught to be angry, you know, by her mother. But I would say I would say the opposite. I would just say, well, Matilda needs to learn not to stamp her foot in rage. She just needs to learn some boundaries, Matilda. Her mother's quite rightly cross. Matilda stamped her foot again. It wasn't a bit of good. She was just sent to bed. So after that, she didn't stamp her foot at her mother anymore, only at Jane the maid, George the gardener, and her little friends. They couldn't send her to bed. They didn't like her at all when she stamped her foot at them. One afternoon, Matilda went to pick blackberries in Farmer Giles's field. She knew where there was a fine hedge of them, and as they were the last of the autumn's feast of blackberries, she meant to have a very nice time. I used to go and pluck blackberries in the autumn. It was good fun. But she found the little old lady there picking away fast and putting the big juicy blackberries into a basket. Matilda stared in rage. I came to pick blackberries, she said. So did I, said the old lady, still picking. I saw them the other day, and I said to myself they should be mine, and no one else's, said Matilda, going red in the face. How funny. That's just what I said to myself, said the old dame, still picking hard. Matilda stared crossly. I want those blackberries, she said. So do I, said the old lady. You can share them, can't you? You've picked the biggest. You're greedy, said rude Matilda. What an unpleasant child you are, said the old dame, staring at Matilda out of curious green eyes. Those eyes should have warned Matilda that the old lady was magic. But people with green eyes are not the same as ordinary folk. If you've got green eyes in the chat, let us know, because you're not ordinary folk. Tell me if you've got green eyes. You're not to talk to me like that, said Matilda, and she stamped her foot. You're not to. Don't stamp your foot at me, or you'll be sorry, said the old lady, and her eyes looked rather fierce. But Matilda didn't care. Not she. She lost her temper all in a hurry and began to shout and stamp. I want those blackberries, stamp, stamp. I want those blackberries, stamp, stamp. I want those blackberries, stamp, stamp, stamp. Now look at how entitled Matilda is, and think of these things not being taught, and why it may have led to a generation of entitled children, and entitled people, and entitled adults, because they're not told these things. Right? They're not told that this is unacceptable. Whereas Matilda or Ina Blyton is saying this is unacceptable behavior again and again. It's all about what is acceptable behavior, what is good behavior, not this. The old lady looked at Matilda in the greatest surprise. My dear little girl, she said, you shouldn't have been a child at all. You should have been a pony. Then you could do all the stamping you please. Give me those blackberries, shouted Matilda. And she stamped so heavily on the grass that she squashed it flat. I don't mind horses stamping at me, but I won't have little girls behaving like this, said the old dame. And she waved a thin brown hand at Matilda. Be a pony. Run away and stamp all you like. And then, to Matilda's enormous dismay, she found that she was no longer a little girl, but a small brown pony with a white star on its head. She had four legs and a long tail. She stamped with her forefoot on the grass, and she opened her mouth to shout, but she neighed instead. Nay, hey, 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 nay, hey, hey, hey. Well, if you want hay, go and get it, said the old lady, going on with her picking. Matilda was frightened by her hoarse voice and ran away round the field. Oh, dear. This was dreadful. She was a pony. Fancy that, a pony. She couldn't speak like a little girl. She couldn't pluck blackberries, for she had no hand. She could still stamp, and she could wave a long tail about. How very, very queer. Matilda wanted to go home, so she ran to the field gate, but it was shut. Matilda stamped her foot, and the old lady laughed. Stamp away. I always love to see a horse stamping with its hoof. It's right for horses to paw the ground. Stamp all you like, little pony, and enjoy yourself. But Matilda wasn't enjoying herself one bit. Supposing the farmer came by and put her into the shaft of the cart to carry his goods to market. Suppose he wanted to ride her. He was such a big and heavy man. And what about her food? She would have to eat grass. Matilda put her big pony head down to nibble the grass to see what it tasted like. It was horrid. She still had the tastes and feelings of a little girl, although she had the body of a pony. Whatever was she going to do? Oh, why, oh, she had stamped at that old woman. Just then, George, John, Lucy, and Fred came into the field. Look, cried Fred, a new pony. Let's ride him. Matilda was full of horror. What, let these children ride on it back? Never. She ran away to the corner of the field and the children followed. The pony stamped her foot at them and the children laughed. He's like Matilda, they cried. He stamps his foot. He stamps his foot just like Matilda. Just then, the children's mother came along and called them. Come out of the field, children. There's no time to play before tea. Come along. Tea? Matilda felt hungry. How she wished she could go home and eat cakes and jam too. But what would her mother say if a pony came running into the house too? Still, she would go home. Perhaps her mother would know, even though she was now a pony. Matilda cried a few big tears out of her large pony eyes. She cantered out of the gate that the children had carelessly left open and went down to the lane to her. The door was open, the pony cantered inside, and there was her mother laying the tea. Good gracious, a horse coming to tea, said Matilda's mother. I never heard of such a thing. Shoo, shoo, go out at once. Matilda went right into the room and put her big pony head on her mother's shoulder. Tears ran down her big brown pony nose. sorry, something tickled me about that. Her big brown pony nose. Well, look at this, cried her mother in the greatest amazement. A pony crying on my shoulder. Poor creature, what's the matter? Matilda tried to get on her mother's knee, but of course, being a pony, she couldn't possibly. Now, pony, don't be silly, said her mother, pushing it away. Do you think you're a little dog or something, trying to sit on my knee? You'll be borrowing my handkerchief to wipe your eyes next. Dear, dear, I don't understand this. I must be in a dream. A voice spoke from next door. No, you're not in a dream. That is Matilda. But she stamped her foot at me, so I changed her into a pony for a time. Horses may stamp when they please, but not children. Oh, dear, cried Matilda's mother, putting her arms around the pony's neck. Now I understand what this poor pony wants. Old woman, you are magic. Change my little girl into her own shape, please. I am sure she will never ever stamp your foot at you again. Will you ever stamp your foot, Matilda? The old dame asked the pony. It shook its big head at once. The old woman waved her hand, and lo and behold, the pony disappeared. And there was Matilda, looking rather small and scared. Goodbye, said the old lady. Remember that only horses stamp, so be careful you don't change into one again. You never know. She went out with a basket of blackberries. Matilda looked at her mother. Don't let me stamp my foot any more, she wept, glad to find that she didn't neigh this time. Well, you must try to remember yourself, said her mother. I can't tell your feet what to do. Matilda laughed through her tears. I'll try and remember, she said. I don't want to eat grass any more, and I don't want a pony stamping about the kitchen, do you, mother? All the same, I hope if Matilda ever does stamp her foot again, it would be so surprising to see her change into a pony. All the same, I hope I'm there if Matilda ever does stamp her foot again, because it would be so... So Enid Blyton ends the story by saying that basically, if this had happened again, she wants to be there just to see a child turn into a pony. So anyway, let's think about the morality of this tale. Okay, let's think about the what this is. Okay, but okay, it seems harsh, right? The old woman turned the child into a pony. But just think about what would happen, right, in a modern story here. If that old woman turned up at the house and said, listen, I've turned your child into a pony, I think the reaction of the modern mother would be something like, well, it would be to want to call the police or the social services or something. But this mother in this story basically just accepts it. She's accept, well, yeah, you were naughty, basically, like you shouldn't, don't stamp your feet. And these are some of the ways in which they want to sue her or something like that. Yeah, exactly. Whereas I think this is one of those little ways in which you can see how the intrusion of the state, for example, into all bits of people's everyday lives kind of stops this natural. I mean, I know magic was used, but basically, like in real life, you know, she wouldn't turn into a pony, but it would have been perfectly acceptable for an old woman like this to, you know, take the child back to its mother and say she was stamping her feet in a very rude way when I was trying to pick blackberries, you know, and she was disciplined and she was punished and she cried. Don't forget, she cried and was made to feel like scared by this. But the moral is just, well, don't do it again. So basically, like, kind of pushed by fear into not stamping her feet. And this is the same mechanism as the interfering Ina, who is basically taught a lesson. It's the same moral as the spell for a lazy boy. These are all like, they're taught a lesson and they're basically like, no, not to do it again, because the consequences are really, really severe for not following whatever the moral is. Okay. So this is like basic discipline. And I think this is something that has really fallen out. It's really fallen out of our culture. And you can see why, right? You can see why the powers that be and the culture police, if you want to try to push this sort of thing into the past. So nobody's reminded, oh, things didn't used to be like this. People used to have like different senses of morals. But think of how much better it would be if people, you know, were instilled with some of these values that they didn't, you know, that nowadays the only real thing that anybody is told is, well, you know, don't say offensive things. You know, all of those things matter much less, you know, not being okay. It's a good thing to tell people not to be racist or sexist or whatever. Fine. But that's not all there is. There has to be other deeper character traits and character, you know, aspects of, you know, basic morality, even underneath that. And all of these are teaching, all of these stories are teaching kids basically to be more respectful of other people. They're teaching the kids, you know, there's a lot of these things are kind of manners, I guess. And the manners are, well, you don't stick your nose into other people's business. Don't be lazy and don't get angry and stamp your feet in public. And I feel like, you know, it's not just the kids now. I feel like these things were already drifting even when I was a kid, and when like my whole generation of the, you know, the early millennials or late Gen Xers or whatever, it really, these things had already started to drift, and it leads to these kind of negative character traits being perpetuated into adulthood, and then you get very entitled generations of people, even like overgrown children, basically as adults. And that's what I think. That's what I think all of this leads to. So, yes, I think this is something worth remembering. So, let's have a look at the super chats. I don't think there's that many, but worth having a look at a few of them before I get out of here. So. Benjamin Shergarworth saying, thanks AA, a cozy stream was much needed. Yes, Deepest Law is all about the cozy, you know, with your flask of weak lemon drink or whatever. Benjamin Gabriel B said, need ASMR in the background to go with this reading. Indeed, yeah, that's a very good suggestion. Benjamin Rood says, I love this. Children should be raised in an innocent pre-World War II bubble. No tech, only books for AAA. Benjamin Rood also says, children need instruction and boundaries. They are like trees. You need to plant stakes to make sure they grow straight, prune branches. They need feeding well and not overwatering. Benjamin Rood says, this is some damn good fathering. Sugar is crack. Benjamin Rood also says, more Enid Blyton, no masks hiding, smiling faces. Jedi Knight Anakin Cringewalker says, Trump was clearly Leslie pilled. Indeed. Seems like Trump had the spell for a lazy boy. Spaghetto says, in 2020, people would consider getting turned into a pony a good thing. That's quite a good point. And Benjamin Rood says, these days, parents have abdicated all responsibility to schools and the state. And I think that is really one of the things that comes true. More Thug Life Bear says, Biden received record turnout in Wisconsin, 5 standard deviations above the mean. Yes, I mean, I'm not going to talk about politics today, but it's clear that there's some shenanigans going on. I would just say keep the faith, hold the line until you hear otherwise on that. Vox Day had a pretty good blog about the way you should be thinking about this, unless they've declared in the, since I've been on this stream. Benjamin Rood says, we are weak children, and that's why we are lost. Indeed. And again, that book, The Fourth Turning, goes into reasons why our generations may have been more mollycoddled and less disciplined than previous ones. So there we go. All right. We are a nation of teenagers. Absolutely. I wish I was disciplined when I was younger, somebody's saying. This is why I wanted to just share a couple of Enid Blyton stories. It seems like a very harsh kind of disciplinarian way of being and thinking. But I actually think that look at how the people of those generations turned out versus what you see today. So there we go. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining me. Now get out.